this is Craig Valentine, host of Early to Rise Radio. Have you ever wanted to become wealthier, healthier, wiser, or just have more time to appreciate the finer things in life? On this show, we reveal what high performers are doing every day to be more successful without sacrificing their personal lives. Early to Rise Radio is sponsored by the Perfect Day Formula. Get your free copy of this game-changing success guide at freeperfectdaybook.com. Now let's get started with today's show. Robert Kiyosaki, author of Rich Dad, Poor Dad, once said, "It's not how much money you make, but how much money you keep, and how hard it works for you, and how many generations you keep it for." So we're going to talk about money today, and you're going to sit in on a deep conversation that I had with my friend Garrett Gunderson, the CEO of Wealth Factory. Obviously, this guy knows about making money. And the New York Times bestselling author of Killing Sacred Cows, a look behind the scenes at the most popular money myths. All right, Garrett is from Salt Lake City, and he was visiting Toronto to speak at the Entrepreneurs EO conference for over 500 attendees. And he's going to share his wealth building secrets. Now, when I heard that he was speaking at this event, I made sure to book a conference room at the hotel, and I took him hostage and I made him spill the beans about a few things, including how you can get more money from the money you make and how you can also save money on your taxes. He revealed the truth about investing with an advisor and what to do instead. And also, we talked about what everybody needs to know in order to get the lowest interest rate on a loan. Really, really deep stuff here and so much more. This is Craig Valentine, host of Early to Rise Radio, and you're going to love this episode. My old friend Garrett has dedicated his career to debunking many widely accepted myths about bringing you prosperity, and he also has an amazingly smooth radio voice, so it's going to be easy listening. We get really excited, though, so make sure to take notes because he's going to save you a lot of money. Now, Garrett is also a fan of the Perfect Day Formula. That's my best-selling book on how to own your day and control your life. You can grab your free copy at freeperfectdaybook.com or download the audiobook from Amazon so that you can keep the motivation and momentum going. All right, Garrett, man, I really loved your book, Killing Sacred Cows, and I just love hanging around you and listening to your amazing radio voice. So we are going to talk about how to save more money and be a better investor. How does that sound?
Sounds good, man, because most people aren't trying to become better investors. They're looking for the right investments, which is actually the wrong thing to do.
Oh, and we are going to talk about stuff that is wrong, 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 the traditional things that we hear in the media, right?
Yep.
Absolutely good. So, well, let's start there. What is wrong with traditional investing or the traditional mindset around it?
It's actually based upon scarcity, and the scarcity mindset is the greatest destroyer of wealth. So if people are coming from a place of fear, lack, doubt, worry, entitlement, luck, like that kind of thinking actually violates principle and therefore keeps people away from having more wealth. And on the other hand, there's this kind of philosophy in finance of accumulation. We're taught to scrimp, sacrifice, save, and delay so that one day, someday, there will be this kind of pot of gold or pile of money, and then people can so-called retire, and people are willing to tolerate a lot in life in the promise of this future. But the accumulation philosophy is born in scarcity, and here's kind of the formula. In accumulation, they believe that wealth is a function of three things. Number one is, how much money can you sock away? Number two is, how much rate of return can you earn? And number three, how long do you have? So usually they're saying invest early, often, and always, regardless of the outcome, because they have things like dollar cost average or notions like you're in it for the long haul. But the problem with that model is, first of all, that it's basically having people feel like it takes money to make money.
Got it.
So that's like, oh, it takes money to make money. So I got to have money to make money. Not true. You got to have value creation. You got to have service. You've got to be able to solve problems. You got to have intelligence. You've got to have relationships. There's the ingredients.
It's almost like it takes value to make money, but it doesn't take money to make money, right?
That's exactly right. It takes value to make money.
And then I like what you said about the luck and the pot of gold. And it just reminds me, you know, what happened last year with Bitcoin. And so many people were, oh, I missed out. But they're still diving in at the end. And there's that crazy mentality. Where do we get this mentality that drives us to make bad decisions with our money?
Man, those greed glands are difficult because I consider myself financially savvy. And I still had a week where Bitcoin and cryptocurrency was entering my dreams.
Right.
And I'm thinking about it. And logically, I'm like, I don't know enough. It's speculative. It's the Wild West right now. So it's like people that make money are the ones that are selling picks and shovels.
Right.
The ones trying to find the gold. And yes, there are these people that kind of got in early and had whatever. But it was hard to resist. Mm-hmm. It becomes seductive because it becomes part of the vernacular and conversation. And there's a lot of this notion of I'm missing out, and that becomes scarcity. And so that scarcity has to start acting irrationally, because the higher the emotion, the lower the financial IQ.
Right.
And that's the danger with these kind of things. So what my final assessment was around crypto is it's here to stay, which one, I'm not sure. So it's a hedge.
Okay.
So all I did was choose 1 month expenses mm-hmm. in a wallet that can sit inside of my safe, set it and forget it.
Got it.
So I don't watch what's happening from day to day. And my co-author of 5 Day Weekend, he owns mines. He owns Bitcoin mining in Iceland. And he just feels like, man, these guys are speculating. Every time he gets, he was in early. When he had 100% return, he cashed out 50%.
Okay.
Then we had another 100% return. He only left in 20% after mm-hmm. that. So he actually capitalized the gains. And instead of thinking of what he missed out on the upside, he considered, what would I be willing to lose or tolerate on the downside, and had very little money at risk because he was part of the methodology rather than just the speculation.
Right, absolutely. It's that, what are you willing to risk? Now, you mentioned three things that about accumulating money. Can you repeat those again? And then we're going to dive deep into that.
Wealth in the accumulation philosophy is believed that it's the amount of money times the rate of return times the amount of time. So this is where compound interest is born. And a lot of people think very favorably about compound interest. But the problem is, there's a lot of misinformation, like that Einstein said it was the eighth wonder of the world. I've heard that over and over, so we researched it. Einstein didn't say that. He was in Austria at a conference where he said compounding numbers was the eighth wonder of the world, and Security National Life in the 1920s said compounding interest. That's completely different, compounding numbers versus compounding interest. So it gets people thinking 30 years from today. I just got to think the long haul. I got to think long term.
Stocks always go up.
Yeah, they always go up. But the problem with that is there's fees that are coming out all the time. Like when someone tells you it takes money to make money, it doesn't take their money to make money. The institutions aren't lending you their money. They're lending you the depositors' money that they've borrowed. And they're charging a higher interest rate than what they're paying out. That's the business model.
And they loan out 10 times more money than they have in the bank.
Yeah, fractionalized banking. They're loaning out, because if I borrow money from a bank, I put it back in the banking system. Mm-hmm. They take a percentage and put it in reserves, and they loan out that dollar that was actually from someone else. So it does create a lot of risk that way, and it also creates a lot of return for them.
Well, let's go into some hidden opportunities that are available kind of in plain sight for everyone. Let's talk about that now.
There's four I's that I think are the most in plain sight things that people can do to improve their financial life. Like this whole accumulation notion of scrimping, sacrificing, waiting for it to all work out takes a long time. It's hard to measure. I said it's high risk equals high return. Or I said it takes money to make money is the first problem. The second one is high risk equals high return is the second thing that people believe to get a higher interest rate.
Yep.
But the more risk, the higher the chance of loss.
Right.
It's the opposite of being an investor. And then the time is, just wait longer. What happens when you want to enjoy the money?
Yeah.
So instead, what you can do to immediately improve your cash flow and your finances is get money back from inefficiency. See, we've all been taught to live within our means at some time in our life. And there's three ways to do it. Most people don't go past budgeting or cutting out. And yeah, if you're a train wreck and you're, you know, off track, that's a good idea. But if you're a business owner and you're making money, it might be a bad idea because it starts to get you to cut out the wrong expenses.
Yes.
See, because there's four types of expenses. The first one is a destructive expense. We should get rid of those.
Yeah.
Right? Like for me, we're here in a hotel room. I'm just glad they don't have the candy out, because I like to be really healthy. But sometimes that sits there and tempts me, and then it's like $10 for a candy bar.
Sure.
Or if I borrow money to buy something that's not an asset and I don't have the cash for it, that's another destructive expense. Or, you know, things that lead people into debt.
Shoes.
The second type is a lifestyle expense. Lifestyle expenses are just things that it's important to pay cash for. The things we enjoy in life, like maybe a nice restaurant, maybe nice clothes, maybe a nice trip, but you just don't borrow for it.
Mm-hmm.
The third type of expense is a protective expense. This is anything from corporate structure to liability insurance to liquidity to anything that helps you transfer risk so that when you have a financial surprise, it doesn't derail you. And then the fourth type of expense is a productive expense. And this is when you become an investor, is when you understand a productive expense. I put in a dollar, more than a dollar comes out the other side. This might be an amazing employee. This might be the right marketing thing. This might be the right mentors. This might be the right infrastructure that you build and invest money in. It doesn't always have to show up as dots on a piece of paper, meaning cash in a bank account. It could show up as something that can produce cash over time. So understanding that's really important, because in living within your means, you can budget, or you can be more efficient, or you can expand your means. So let's focus on efficiency, because these are immediate return things. The first one, and I apologize to all the Canadians listening, because I'm just going to say IRS. Now that could be, you know, the revenue service anywhere, but
And we're in Canada doing this, so that's why he's apologizing. He's apologizing to me, I suppose.
And I just feel like it's very Canadian to apologize.
Right.
You know, I need to say sorry, and then I feel like I've done the right thing here.
There you go.
So, but it's getting money back, because 93% of business owners overpay their taxes. The reason they overpay their taxes is that it's just lack of knowledge, wrong team, wrong structure. So here is the structure. The three main things to do to save on tax. Number one, you got to be proactive and have a team. That team should consist of at least a bookkeeper or controller or even a CFO, depending on the size of your organization or your finances. Number two, a CPA. If you're in the States, it's a CPA, where you're just finding out what all the tax deductions are so you can take advantage of the tax deductions. The third is an attorney. An attorney helps you set up the right corporate structure, or can do something called reclassifying your income. I'll spend more time on deductions and reclassification of income, because those are the other two strategies. And then fourth, if you own your own commercial building, you can actually have an engineer come in and help you accelerate your depreciation for tax purpose. So you can actually get faster tax deductions if you own a building. So you might have up to four people on your team, but at minimum, you want two. Someone to keep your books so that you have the data in a timely manner, and someone to make sure you take care of your tax deductions. Now,
I just, when you said that last thing about the engineer, I know so many of my clients are gym owners or brick and mortar owners who actually own the real estate too, and their wheels better be turning after hearing that one.
Yeah, you're up to 39 years before you get all your tax deductions on standard straight line depreciation.
Right.
But if you do cost segregation, that's the title of it, where the engineer comes and analyzes it, there might be things you get a write-off in 3 years, 5 years, 9 years. So you're collapsing that and getting that benefit today rather than waiting forever. So that's a big one. Now, the last piece of the first part here is that every 3 years, have a different set of eyes on your taxes, because you can go back and amend your returns. So you go back 3 years if you missed major things and get the IRS to write you a check. Back in 2008, I did this, because in 2006, we had a company plane that crashed with two of my business partners in it, and they died.
Oh my gosh.
So, I mean, I just wasn't thinking straight. I was emotional. So I didn't meet with my tax team. I didn't get them the data. I was just trying to keep the pieces together.
Yeah.
Right. Well, in 2008, when things settled down a little bit, I was able to go back and find out that I'd overpaid my taxes, $40,000 for the federal, $15,000 for the state in 2006. And I got a check back from the IRS. So you can go back and amend your returns.
How far can you go back?
3 years.
Oh, just 3 years.
Yes, 3 years. And okay. So here, let me give some big amendment examples.
Yep.
Like, this is the one I'm looking at this year. This happened to be the year where I had a different set of eyes on my taxes.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something in the United States called Section 199. So Section 199 states, hey, did you do any research and development for your business? Or even something called domestic production. Did you do anything in software or assembling equipment? Because you're talking about gym owners, or
sure,
knowledge around different exercise structures and systems. Like, so it's things where you did domestic research, and like I did books,
mm-hmm,
right? That's part of it for me. I created video programs. So because I didn't take that to India or China to do it, I did it all here domestically. I can take 9% of the income I earned on that and write it off, in addition to what I expensed for the employees and the hard costs for it.
Wow.
So I'm in the middle of doing that study and going back to get money back. Now, in the new tax law of 2018, they got rid of that, and it's now 199A. So it's just a standard 20% deduction.
Oh.
But you can go back to the previous year. So that's the first part of the framework, is building the team, being proactive with that team. So that means meeting them at least once a quarter, even if it's for 20 minutes, just to talk about your situation and find out what you can do to take advantage of things, and then look to amend every 3 years. Now,
well, so question there is, does that, you know, you've got your bookkeeper and you've got your CPA. Does that mean just going and getting a different CPA to do an analysis?
Yep. And this is what I tell the CPA. I say, look, I have a CPA that has been with me that I love. But what I like to do is pay you your normal hourly fee to come and look at my taxes, to have a conversation and see if I've missed anything. If you find anything, I'll double your rate. I'll double your rate so they have full incentive. And here's why it's important. There's so many pages of interpretation around the tax law, and even the tax law is a pretty thick book that we would all be bored reading. And we also get in routines. Like if you get to know your tax team, they get to know you. Might forget to ask certain questions. They might get in a certain like, oh yeah, I think we did that. Like, and if you're only talking to them during the busy season, their lack of sleep, they're super busy. So it's pretty easy to miss these kind of things. I think it happens quite a bit.
So you go at any, you go at the slow time of year for them and say, hey, let's have this conversation.
Yep.
Okay. Just before we get off track on this one.
Like November is an ideal time.
Got it. And then, so speaking of, you mentioned the 2018 tax rules. What other big changes came in there that business owners should be wide-eyed about?
It was supposed to be this amazing thing, and it really hasn't been all that amazing. They lowered some of the tax rates. They went from 7 brackets to 6, but they also took away a lot of things. Like there's only about half of the amount of mortgage that you can write off now than before. They cut that in half. You can't pay employees certain fringe benefits and write them off that you used to be able to. They took some of that away. They talked about this thing called the pass-through deduction, which was going to be the big, big thing. Like you could be a corporation, you get this big pass-through deduction, and you might have your tax rate down to 15%. Well, if you're a service-based professional, they said that doesn't count for you. And then they create an equation, which is a lesser than equation of how you can actually calculate whether you get this pass-through deduction. And most accountants I talk to are relatively confused about how it all works. So even my tax team, it took them 20 minutes to describe how it works to me. So it created a little bit of complexity, they took away a lot more than they gave, but just the overall brackets got reduced a little bit. Mm-hmm. So, I have a guide I'm happy to give everyone for free that we went through and just finished in the last few weeks here.
Oh, great.
Interpreting everything and giving 300 tax ideas.
Okay, cool.
So, that's the first part. The next two pieces are, okay, so the first thing is build a team, be proactive. The second thing is take advantage of all your deductions. And this is how you do that. You ask the question, how does this relate to my business? And by the way, if you're not a business owner, you pay more in tax than business owners do. That's one of the big advantages. And so when you look at your expenses and say, how does this relate to my business? You might not know what does and what doesn't relate to your business, or you might be like, well, could I make this related? Let me give you some examples of things that you could do immediately and put on the ground. Number one, there's something called the Augusta rule. The Augusta rule says, Craig, you can rent your house out for 14 days a year and you don't have to claim personal income on that rent. But let's say you had your business rented out. Let's say you said, okay, I'm going to host something for my clients, or I'm going to host something for my vendors. I'm going to host something for my employees. And we cater stuff at my house all the time this way. We write a check from the business to me personally. That's a tax deduction for the business. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't count as income to me as long as it's 14 days or less because of this Augusta rule. Mm-hmm. Now, if you go over 15, then it becomes a rental. So you have to pay tax. If you keep it under that amount.
That's 14 total days or
14 total days
in the year?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, and I really recommend you do it during times of peak times in your area.
Sure.
So if you live in Austin City Limits, South by Southwest, you know, Formula One, when those things are going on, all the hotels jack up their prices. And you're basically saying, this is what a conference room would have cost me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's just a simple lease agreement. Another example of a deduction or an expense that becomes a deduction is for those that have kids. If your kids are under 18, the new law did state that instead of paying kids $6,300, it's now up to $12,000. So you can pay your kids $12,000, write it off for the business, and have that potentially be tax-free to the kids.
Do they have to be of a certain age?
They just have to be able to be responsible for the items that you give them. So okay. Here's an example. You have a three-month-old. The most I could think of is a $2,500 deduction or a $2,500 payment for modeling fee.
Right. So they you had your dog. Just before, Garrett was telling me about how his dog, his 3-month-old puppy or 7-month-old puppy, was in a commercial, and I guess you could do the same with your 3-month-old baby.
Yeah. So that's a union standard for $2,500. You know, I missed out on that when my kids were that age because I hadn't thought of the way and had it validated.
Sure.
But now I'm paying my kids the full $12,000. I was actually paying it before the tax law changed because I really thought, like, okay, I've had them come to events where they're handing out books. I've had them working on a kid's book with me on finance with one of them. I have the other one working on an Amazon business because we work with a lot of e-commerce people. So I've found items for them to work for and work towards to earn this money. And that's fully tax deductible to me, but 0% tax to them. So that's another... you know, expense turned into a deduction. I also have, Wealth Factory is one of my main companies and we have a headquarters, but then I also have my intellectual property company. And so I kicked my kids out of their playroom, turned that into an office at my house. I can now write off half my utilities and I get to write off a home office deduction for that particular business. So that's another expense turned into a tax deduction. So, I mean, you have annual trip allowances. So if you do your annual meetings, I tend to think better when I'm in Italy or Napa than I do in Utah where I live. So my wife and I go and we do this retreat and then we just take notes at one of the meals and talk about our year. And now all of a sudden that trip's a write-off. So that's another example. So that's 4 or 5 examples people can kind of put on the ground. First one was to be proactive and build a team. Second one is to turn your expenses into deductions. And that's mainly like a CPA's job to help you with.
Got it.
I brainstorm with them and they say, that's perfectly fine. Or they say, nah, that's not how the law works. And I'm just a brainstormer on those calls.
Got it.
So I don't get myself into trouble. They either sign off on it and tell me invalidate through the law, or they tell me that doesn't work, but I'm unbridled by the law on that call, and then we only implement the things that make sense.
Yeah, absolutely. So that was the first I, was the inefficiencies,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, on the IRS. And by the way, the third piece to tax is reclassification of income. So if you can set up the right corporations, you can move active income to passive. Active income has up to 15.3% more tax added to it because of self-employment tax. A distribution, if you're the right corporation, might avoid that 15.3%. Or if you charge the highest possible rent for the building that you own to yourself, that comes in as passive income, 1099 instead of W-2, that could be a lot lower. Or if you could take ordinary income and turn it into capital gains, that would be another big way to do it. Or if you're an LLC, by having a spouse or someone that can be a 1% partner, you can now tax as a partnership rather than just as a standard LLC, and that might lower your taxes. Or let's say that you have supplements that you sell as a gym owner, and that gets you less than $50,000 of income. By putting that in a C corporation, you have a lower tax in that C corp for the first $50,000 than you do an LLC or an S corp. Plus, you can retain your earnings. So you learn how to use these different corporations to your advantage to reclassify your income. And the goal is active to passive, ordinary income to capital gains, or taxable income to tax-free income. Those are the three main things you think about in reclassification. So I know we spend a lot of time on the first I here to efficiency, but
right. There's
a lot there, because what if you save $20,000 a year in tax? How long would it take you to invest money on the wealth equals money times rate times time to create $20,000 a year? At least 10 years, if not 15 years, if not 20 years. And if we could just do this through financial savvy and insight right now, that's immediately hitting the bottom line.
Right. And that doesn't require you to have great skills to be a great salesperson, to, you know, do great copywriting. I mean, if you're a business owner, this is money in the bank just by playing by the rules and making sure that everybody's doing their job.
Keep way more of every dollar you make and life gets better, because this all hits the bottom line too. This isn't revenue where then you're adding space and employees and infrastructure. The only expense you have on this is maybe your accountant.
Sure. Yeah, beautiful. I really love that idea. So in November, I'm going to go to another CPA, pay him normal rate and double his rate if he can give me some savings here,
yep,
right?
Exactly.
Awesome. Because as a Canadian owner of a American business, I do pay the IRS as well. I pay them first, actually. They make sure they get it first, and then the Canadian government gets whatever remainder. All right, so now we covered the first I, which is inefficiency. What's the next one?
So the first I is IRS in the inefficiency.
Okay.
So the second I is interest.
Okay.
And a lot of people overpay interest, especially if they have more than one loan. And I'll give you kind of the four C's which strategically lower interest rates. The first one is credit. If people can get a credit score above 780, that massively helps them out.
Okay.
The second thing is collateral. So if you have a paid off car and you refinance that car, you can usually get like 1.9, 2.9% interest rates versus maybe business loans or credit cards or anything else, which might be anything from 5, 6, 7, up to 10%. So collateral can really lower your interest rate. The third thing is the right cash flow reporting. We see people not have the right cash flow reporting, like someone that donates to, we were talking about religion just before this, that might donate to their religion, but instead of putting it as a charitable contribution, we just saw someone put it as an education expense. Well, education expense is going to hurt your income from a loan standpoint, although it may have the same tax implication and tax savings, where if it was a charitable deduction, that doesn't harm you or hurt you in acquiring a loan. So you've got to make sure your cash flow reporting is proper. We see people put things in the wrong schedule on their taxes, so their income looks improper, so it doesn't count towards, you know, benefiting them for a loan or how they write things off. And then the last C is connections. Just having the right connections. We've gotten people as low as 1.25% interest rates by getting them into private banks. Or we've gotten, there was a doctor recently financing their commercial property at 6.5%. We ended up giving them 4.17% just by getting them. And it's not like we own these financial institutions. We don't get paid by them. We just know ones that have certain like preferences or like who they would prefer, you know, who they like to lend to or what kind of structure. So those are the four C's: credit, collateral, cash flow reporting, and connections, and that can really lower your interest rate. So
just to go back to the example you used, you said, so it was one of your clients, when they were making a donation to their church, they put it down as an educational donation?
Yes, education expense.
Instead of
as a charitable donation.
Why did they do that?
Because they felt like they were getting all this value from their church and what they were learning.
So that's what they wrote it down as.
Yeah, and I mean, that's maybe a silly example, but we see all the time where people just have certain income that's on the wrong line.
Got it.
That will harm them.
Okay.
You know?
And that's something that everybody should just generally run by. Their CPA should know everything.
Yeah, and just having well-documented and organized income statements.
Okay.
So that all of a sudden when you go get a loan, you can show them exactly what's going on.
Okay.
Because you're basically telling them a story. Hey, here's why I'm a good borrower. And if you can show that you're a good borrower, then they're going to want to lend to you, because institutions lend money to people who don't need it. They don't like lending to people who really need it.
Right, right. Always go when you don't need it.
So to really figure out this interest thing, there's a couple strategies I have. One is, if you're trying to pay loans off, you only pay off one at a time, and you choose to pay them off based upon their cash flow index. So all you do is you take the loan balance and divide it by the minimum required payment.
Okay.
Loan balance divided by minimum required payment, it's going to spit out a number. So line up every loan individually, you know, divide them individually by their minimum payment, not what you're currently paying. And the one that comes out with the lowest number is the only one you pay extra to. And the reason you pay extra to that one and no other one is because it's going to free up your cash flow faster, because it's saying that you have a cash hog on your hands. You have a relatively little amount of money in relationship to the payment that you're paying. So a low cash flow index, it takes into consideration with the interest rate, but it's not the main consideration.
So highest interest rate is not the biggest thing.
We're looking at what's going to free up your cash flow the fastest, because freeing up your cash flow frees up your debt to income, which might mean that you can get better loans.
Got it.
Or restructure loans. Or there's other ways, by paying off certain loans might boost your credit score. Boosting your credit score might mean we could renegotiate other interest rates. So the first thing is we figure out the cash flow index. The second thing is we restructure loans if we can restructure them. If we can refinance, maybe refinance loans into your mortgage or into your car that lower your interest rates or lower your payments, that's more money into your life that you can now attack that lowest cash flow index loan with. Or the third thing is, you might have underperforming assets like a certificate of deposit or a savings account that isn't earmarked. And you can actually cash that out if it's earning a lower interest rate than you're paying on your higher interest rate loans. And that's a guaranteed return for you. you know? So that's one of the big ways to really improve someone's cash flow is really looking at their loan structures, restructuring them, renegotiating. It's pretty easy to renegotiate a credit card. They're almost always going to lower your interest rate if you just know what to say and who to talk to. The first person you call probably has no authority. But if you say, I'm considering balance transferring, canceling, or can I talk to your deals department? I'm looking to get a card. Then you can a lot of times get that interest rate lower.
Okay. You get to the right person. Yep. And then the right thing to say to that right person is?
I'm looking to cancel is usually the most effective. But if you're not really looking to cancel,
okay.
I don't know if you want to say that, you could say, hey, I'm looking to do a balance transfer. I want to, before I go look at other companies, I want to, since I'm already with you, I want to check it out with you guys.
Yeah.
They'll send you to the retention department. The retention department has some flexibility on what those interest rates are.
Very good. I mean, that's a huge game changer right there for a lot of people. So does that cover the second eye interest?
Yep, interest.
So, okay.
And there's, you know, there's, if we had hours, I could go into a lot more detail, but that gives you the basic infrastructure. The third eye is insurance.
Okay.
And we don't have to spend a lot of time on this because it's not as much about which company you choose. It's about how you structure your insurance. There's a lot of duplicate coverages, improper structure that leads to unnecessary dollars being lost in the insurance world. So perfect examples of this would be low deductibles. I mean, there's people with low deductibles that if they got in a fender bender, they actually wouldn't make a claim. So why not raise your deductible? That'll lower your premiums. Or people that don't have an umbrella policy, otherwise known as an excess liability policy. You can add that on top of your home and vehicles if you have more than one, and it will give you liability coverage on all of them through one policy rather than trying to increase your limits on each individual policy to protect you. And then you just lower your individual policies to the minimum required for that umbrella to kick in. Some people have more than the minimum required, and that's a duplicate coverage. You're not getting the extra insurance. You're just paying extra for no reason.
Right.
So that's
who's the best person to look through all that?
A property and casualty agent. The problem is most of them are order takers.
Got it.
So they're just looking to get the best price for you through which company would be a better pricing.
And they got you in this trouble less in the first
than,
place.
Probably, yeah, less right? than like, have you protected yourself? Because I find most people don't have the right risk transferred there. The most expensive dollar of insurance that you pay for is the first dollar. The least expensive is the last, meaning
right.
a $0 deductible or a $100 deductible is much more expensive than $1,000. And if you go to $1,000, you might be able to get an extra $100,000 of liability coverage for the same dollar. Because that's the catastrophic thing. It's less likely to happen, but it would be the more devastating thing. So this is my main sentiment with insurance. Insure the catastrophic, never the inconsequential.
Okay.
Have no insurance or drop your insurance or increase your limits on things inconsequential. So if you have 6 months liquidity just sitting in a bank account, you don't have to have a 1 month elimination period of when your disability kicks in. You can make it 6 months. And by increasing it, it lowers your premium. Or you can drop your short-term disability policy because you've got the short-term handled by having enough cash on hand.
Right.
So those are the inconsequential things. The consequential things are, you know, limits of liability, disability, you know, life insurance. Like I call those human life value protectors.
Okay.
Property value is protecting your home and your car.
Yeah.
If something happened to those, you'd probably be fine. But on these other human life value protectors, which protect your income, which protect, you know, lawsuit against your future income or your assets, those are the catastrophic things that I like to see people protect, even though they're less tangible.
Sure.
They're more important. So it's just how you structure those things can make a big difference in insurance.
Fantastic. All right. And then the fourth I.
Investments.
Okay.
And the first place I look at investments is, are there hidden fees? Are there non-performing fees? Are there excessive fees? Because a lot of times there are. And then the second thing I look for is, do you have downside protection? A lot of people are fully exposed. So if the market goes down, their accounts just go down. But there are mechanisms where you can trigger that to move to cash and not participate in the full downside. And that's going to be different for each person. But I look at what level does your mindset go down with the market? Mm-hmm. At that level, you should move to cash.
Right.
So we had a bunch of clients in 2008 that had something called a trailing stop loss. So when the market started to tank, they got moved to cash, not having to call their broker, not having to file any paperwork. It was already set up, so automatically moved, and they avoided a ton of the downside. And they were happy because they didn't have, they weren't watching the news feeling bad. You know, there's even mechanisms where you might be able to participate in the upside and have full downside protection. I mean, learn about these things so that you're not fully exposed. But the fees make a big difference. Like if you had $100,000 that you could invest for 30 years and you could theoretically earn 10%, it grows to 1.74 million. But if you had to pay 0.8% of that in non-performing fees, like admin fees, legal fees, something called a 12B1 fee, which pays for marketing for these institutions, now it only grows to 1.4 million. So it's a $340,000 difference off less than 1%. Mm-hmm. I don't like how the financial institutions always talk percentages.
And that's really low at 0.8%.
Yeah. Like, if we go to 2%, which you could find a lot of times, especially if it's inside of an RSP or a 401k or something, now it's only going to grow to a million. That's $740,000 difference to your bottom line.
Right.
The difference between 8% and 10%, because this is logarithmic. This is exponential growth. It's not 1 + 1 = 2. We're in, you know, right, geometry and you know, multiplication, essentially.
Yeah, the 8 is not scaling linearly, right, to the 10.
So that's what we have to look at. Is stop thinking in percentage and start looking at dollars.
Okay.
And when you look at dollars, then you're going to have a lot better assessment. But, you know, there's just 96%+ of managed funds don't outperform index funds,
right,
after 20 some years, right? You got to say, is it worth it? Is it worth it because my guy takes me golfing? Is it worth it because, you know, I get tickets to the game or whatever? Like, is it really doing what it's supposed to do? And especially when it's inside of retirement plans, because retirement plans can be riddled with a bunch of non-performing fees.
Right. Is it worth it for all that stress of watching the market compared to an index fund, right?
Right.
All right. So we have the four I's, which are get money back from inefficiency.
Yep.
Make sure that you have the right interest. Make sure you have the right insurance, and then also the investments. Is there anything else on the investment stuff that you wanted to mention?
Those are the main things without looking at someone's statements. It goes back to part two of hey, just cash these things out if they're not performing and you have higher interest rate loans.
Right.
Maybe invest back into the infrastructure of your business, invest in people, processes, and automation and technology that support your business, because don't feel guilt that you have to invest outside of your business. That's antiquated rules that follow this accumulation philosophy. And maybe it's good for the masses, but it's not necessarily good for the entrepreneur. It can harm the entrepreneur to starve out their business, to take good money and put it in places that you don't understand, you have no control over. And why fund someone else's dream and someone else's boardroom before you funded your own?
Yeah.
And especially because businesses in the short term can get 50% rates of return by allocating dollars somewhere where that's going to be really hard to do with Fortune 500 stocks. They're not going to get that kind of return because they've saturated the market too heavily by now.
Absolutely. All right. So here's an interesting question that I came upon after reading some of your material. So you had a quote in there about there's something that 92% of people worth $5 million or more all have in common. And how can we have this for ourselves?
I got this quote from a book John Bowen wrote, and it's they own a business.
So okay.
As much as people believe that finance comes down to how much you save, how early you save, what kind of return you get, like the reality is that model hasn't been very effective. It has a more like a 92% failure rate,
mm-hmm,
right? Where people are not economically independent at age 65.
No.
If they stop working,
right,
their assets won't replace their income. So if you own a business, you have this strategic advantage. So if we look at the book Money Master the Game, as all these billionaires are being interviewed, a lot of them don't mention owning a business. Only one did, Mark Farber. All the other ones are telling you to invest in stuff that they built as a business, but you investing in that isn't going to make you the billionaire that they were.
Got it.
You're just supporting it. So like there's this fundamental philosophy that investing equals stocks and bonds rather than ideas and people. Mm-hmm. I look at investments as ideas and people and business. And so I think if you want to become a better investor, you focus instead of diversify. You invest in what you know instead of outside of your expertise. And if you're not sure where to invest, you stay in cash until the time is right. And then you can pounce on opportunities. That's what's going to get you a lot more wealth. And if you haven't fully invested in your business, start there.
Yeah, that's what, you know, Buffett calls it the circle of competence.
And yeah, I love that.
Yeah, exactly. And it goes back to what you said at the start. You know, you did this analysis of Bitcoin. You know, do I understand it? You know, am I sure where it's going? And you made the conservative decision to do what you did with it. So that's interesting.
And by the way, when I went to put $25,000 in it,
yeah,
and I always have due diligence team. And I couldn't explain. I have a rule. If I can't explain it in a paragraph or less, I can't do it.
Right.
So I didn't explain it in a paragraph. So the team said no. That would have turned into, at its peak, 600,000 right now, probably more like 340,000.
Yeah.
And that's part of the reason why it was permeating my dreams a little bit. But I was like, okay, every now and again, you can get lucky gambling.
Sure.
But don't confuse that with investing.
Right.
I didn't know enough that if I would have allocated that to know, and who knows, that might have seduced me into doing more or distracting me, or like it was one of these exercises that as a spokesperson in the financial world, it was good for me to go through.
Yes.
It was good for me to experience and to understand like how seductive these things are and how compelling the stories can be. And I'm fairly not like I study finance a lot, and there was still like a lot of confusion around it. As much as I could say, oh, it could be deflationary, I could give you all the sound bites.
Mm-hmm.
But to just describe it really succinctly, I didn't have it down.
So how does one combat that human nature of our greed glands and our fear of missing out and our fear of loss and the way that we act irrationally with money?
You have other people around you that you – so I have this guy Ryan, another guy Norm, and another guy Andrew. That's my team.
Before they're your outside eyes.
And they're like – we get emotional about our stuff,
right?
But they're going to be not emotional about it.
Sure.
So they can look at it from a different perspective. It's kind of like if you're stuck in a massive problem and you're super stressed about it, if you could have an outside person that's not stressed about it, they can have a different perspective and maybe ask a question you can't ask yourself or see a solution that you can't see simply because of that emotion.
Yeah, I use the phrase outside eyes. You know, you need outside eyes on the problem. And then I also use the phrase, well, give some advice to somebody going through a problem. And then take that advice that you gave them and give it to yourself. And in most cases, it's the same thing because it is, as you mentioned, you no longer have emotion tied to the problem or the solution. And that's really the key in this, is taking the emotion out of money, right?
Totally.
Beautiful. So let's talk more about some traits of the wealthy.
Yeah.
You know, what is it that allows someone to earn wealth, build wealth, keep wealth, and even pass on wealth to the next generation?
So we'll talk about a couple people in this. We'll talk about the Vanderbilts who didn't do it, the Rockefellers who did, and then someone like today that built it with Ted Turner.
Sure.
I mean, those would be the main examples. So the Vanderbilts had more money than the U.S. Treasury. And when Cornelius died...
He was the guy who built it all from shipping, right?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. And then so they had so much money. And after he died, Cornelius died, and his oldest son doubled their net worth in 9 years by the time he died.
Wow.
But then just 54 years later, the first Vanderbilt died broke. They didn't really have conversations around earning and living with purpose and figuring out skill set. Their conversations were more around which mansion that they could build. They built 10 of them in Manhattan. Most of them have been torn down by now. They built the Breakers in Rhode Island. It's not even owned by the Vanderbilt family anymore. And even Vanderbilt University, it was just $1 million they donated to get that thing started long ago. So Anderson Cooper's an heir of the Vanderbilt family. He didn't get any money. Gloria didn't have anything to give him. He faked press credentials to even make it in the field that he's in. So they just didn't have a philosophy. And there's this kind of triangle or trifecta of how you have this work, because the Rockefellers figured it out. The first is a family office.
Okay.
So a family office, for the Rockefellers, it meant one group of financial team that only works for them. But now you can have like family offices without having to be Rockefeller level.
Sure.
So you have an attorney, an accountant, an investment advisor, cash flow specialists, risk managers, all working together. This is what I built my firm.
Is that generally for people with 10 million or more? Or is it even?
It used to be like 30 million, 50 million. When I saw that when I was 22 years old, I said, I'm going to build that for the entrepreneur that doesn't have net worth. And it took me 12 freaking years to build. It was a lot more work than I anticipated.
Mm-hmm.
And what's mine's called is a virtual family office. So I could work all over the US and Canada and have advisors support that. So now you have a team that works cohesively and together and shares the same philosophy. The second part of that is a family retreat. This is a structure where you have regular meetings, where you're transferring philosophies, you're establishing core values, you're creating family rules, you're creating traditions. You're making sure to spend time together so that the information transfers to the next generation's mind, so it's, they're not surprised that you're wealthy or they're not just entitled. So it really is a structure. We just finished a 2.5-day event doing just this. people walked away with their family mission statement, their family creeds and symbols, and you know, like, so they have their crest. It's like all the things that we've been doing for businesses for years now, right?
Yeah.
So you establish a culture and you have your vision and you have your values, and like, why aren't we doing those for that stuff for families? So that's the next piece that the wealthy do really good.
Yeah, and you don't even have to have wealth to do that. I mean, you should be doing that in every family.
Before the wealth comes in.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. And then one of my mentors, a guy named Bill Bonner, has written a book called Family Fortunes. Yeah. I'm sure you've read it. And they had newsletters about family offices. And we're actually interviewing for one of our future podcasts a woman named Joanne Stern, who lives up actually in Park City now, up by you in Utah. And she works with high net worth families and walks them through all the problems that wealth brings. And she has been writing articles and books about it for years, because that's generally where the money gets lost, right?
Totally. It's shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves, they're saying, by the generations, yeah. Right?
And so, and the funny thing is,
all these cultures, right? Like Japan, a clod for a clod, or like just depending on the culture, rice patty to rice patty. These are sayings, you know. So yeah, all the cultures have these kind of things. And then that third piece is the family constitution.
Okay.
So governments have constitutions, and certain constitutions make a huge difference. Well, what about having your family constitution? Right now, people create estate plans written by attorneys that no one wants to read other than the legal community.
Right.
So why not have a book about the most important lessons, signposts, guides, a constitution for your family? When you have those three things, that's how you really create sustainable wealth. Whether that's a small amount of money or a large amount of money. And then at the center of this, what the Rockefellers did, because they're on their sixth generation, over 150 people benefiting from that trust. Mm-hmm. They've had bank presidents, senators, like, you know, people that are actually out in the world doing things, is they actually bring in a life insurance policy on each one of their trustees or beneficiaries of the trust, so that when they die, it replenishes the trust in case there's economies that potentially wipe part of it out, or businesses that fail. And so it just continues to replenish what those people use. And banks have been doing this for years. They've been taking authority reserves and buying insurance policies. And then Walmart, GE, a lot of these big companies buy insurance policies on their key executives when they die. It replenishes what they paid them in their pensions. So it's a technology that GE really figured out in 1952, but the Rockefellers have been using even before that. And so in my book, What the Rockefellers Do, I actually lay out exactly how they do that. But it's this... that's kind of the center, and then you got the family office, the family retreat, and then you've got the family constitution, and then you kind of have this insurance plan that keeps replenishing that trust so it can last. And then eventually what you do is you treat it like a family bank. All the money in the trust finances everything for the family, and you earn interest rather than paying the interest to the banks.
Well, that's amazing. Now, you mentioned one of your books there. We've talked about another one, Killing Sacred Cows. Walk us through each one that you have and where people in different situations should start.
Cool. And I'm happy, like, at wealthfactory.com/podcast, people can get my books for free.
Okay, great.
So just so they have those resources. But the first book I wrote was Killing Sacred Cows, and that's really a roadmap of how to avoid the landmines and misinformation so that you can detect it, so the subtle lies don't lead you astray. 9 main myths that now all of a sudden when you read it, you will be able to recognize them. The next book I wrote, I co-authored called Portal to Genius. It's actually a book that's a fictional story that is kind of like 10,000 true stories in it, sure. Right? And it's about launching and starting a business and dealing with tough cash flow times and how to be resourceful. So it's like putting these principles into action through a story format. The book I wrote after that is called The Money Tree. Guild and Media is distributing that. And that book is scarcity versus abundance, and it just walks down the two paths.
Okay.
And it's really, you know, it's like 100-some pages. It's really straightforward, simple. And one side shows the tree growing, one shows it dying, and it just keeps showing the branches each chapter and kind of unveils the whole plan.
A really good one for young people to read, I guess.
Great for them, and just great for anyone that's dealing with scarcity.
Got it.
You know, because I think we all get hit with it, and sometimes people don't even recognize it. They just think this is how it is. But if you have footprints of failure, you have levels of frustration, those are signs of scarcity, and that book is just really good at, like, helping people lay it out and figure out what to do. So it gives really strong solutions. Killing Sacred Cows on the new edition too, I finally created some great solutions, because the first time it was more like, here's the problem, here's how to identify it. This last version we did, we put all these great resources so people could go and have, like, worksheets and ways to actually, you know, put the pieces together. The next book I wrote was What Would the Rockefellers Do? And that book is great because whether you start with $50 a month or $5,000 a month. It's the infrastructure that's been my never fail me strategy since I started in 1998. And it, as I continue to do that strategy, it kept being unveiled and unveiled. And actually someone that's part of the Rockefeller family office reached out and I interviewed them for the book. And so it's really showing like, what's this, the families I talked about and the insurance structure at the center, it goes through that. So that's a phenomenal book, whether you're just starting or whether you're really established. And then the last book that just is out in bookstores right now is 5-Day Weekend.
Okay.
So I co-authored that with Nick Halleck, the guy I said does a lot of crypto. He's just a great investor.
Okay.
He's a great investor, and I'm great at describing the details. And so it was a nice partnership that way.
Awesome. And then in addition to all your books, you have the podcast you mentioned, the wealthfactory.com/podcast.
Yeah, and that's just because I'm on a podcast. It's a way for you to grab these books and get resources and build a relationship. So Killing Sacred Cows and What Would the Rockefellers Do? People can download that. Cash flow guides, like a lot of the stuff I'm talking about, I'm giving so much information in a short time. People are like, how do I implement that? So we put together just some special, you know, pieces for people on podcasts.
Got it. And then what about your weekend retreats that you have for business owners? Tell us more about those.
Yeah, so we do wealth acceleration workshops almost every month. And that's A to Z going through finances. Were you set? Were you not financially set? Where's your financial blind spots? What's your economic independence number? What are the cash flow things you can do immediately to get there? What things can you do to scale your business? And how does this all relate to living a better life and a life you love? I believe we don't get a second chance to create a legacy that lasts and live a life that we love. So that is really about putting the pieces together. No sponsors, no outside speakers. We just roll up the sleeves and bring a little bit of entertainment and fun to finance, and people walk away knowing what that plan is. We also do...
Who's that for?
That's really for business owners doing between $1 and $10 million of revenue.
Great.
People that are doing below $1 million, we actually just created a program called Wealth Architecture where they can meet with someone one-on-one every other week. We do 2 webinars a month, and there's live Q&A on it. And then it's got this entire financial network so they can have attorneys, accountants, and everything. So that's for people that are between $100,000 and $1 million of revenue. That's the program for them. The workshops for $1 million and above. And then for people above $10 million, we have an advanced roundtable, which is just a 1 day where I go through deeply advanced strategies that you can get access that you wouldn't have if you didn't have that level of income.
That's fantastic, Garrett. I really appreciate that. So wealthfactory.com/podcast to go and get all the resources,
yep,
the books, the worksheets, all this stuff to get started. And then if somebody's listening with the business, 1 to 10 million, get to one of his, what do you call it again?
Wealth Acceleration Workshop. And there, you'll just get on a phone call. You can go to, if you go to wealthfactory.com/private.
Okay.
You fill out a few questions to get into this, and then you'll talk to someone on the phone. So it's invite only based upon fill out the like 8 questions, whatever, get on a phone call. And then you actually get 3 phone calls before you come out. Like, great. We just really want to like dive in and get people's situation figured out.
Awesome, man. Thank you so much. It's been really helpful. Anything else you wanted to mention?
Before you try to make more money, keep a lot more of what you make. Forget about budgeting. Set up just a separate account. Pay yourself first, live off the rest, and it's going to save you a boatload of time.
And think abundantly, right?
Think abundantly, man. That's the game changer.
Awesome. Wow, that might be the most profitable hour you have all year. So make sure to grab Garrett's free cash flow bonuses at wealthfactory.com/podcast. I can't wait to hear about how Garrett's wisdom helps you get rich and stay rich, okay? So you can contact me directly at craig@godfather.com with your success stories. And if you have any more questions about making money or building a business, keep on sending them in. You can email me, you can send them on Instagram or Facebook or Twitter. Just make sure you get a hold of me on Instagram at @realcraigvalentine. And when you're ready to go to the next level, okay, when you're ready to be that type of person that could use Garrett's services, well, first of all, you have to make the money, you have to build the business. And I'd love to see you at one of my business building workshops. The workshops that I do, the masterminds that I run, are for business owners, authors, and coaches looking to get to the next level. And when you join one of my coaching programs, when I help you, you're also going to get 12 months of coaching and accountability follow-up from me after our day together. But we have to start with that day in person because that's where the best coaching happens. And then after, I keep you on track for success and I solve any future problems that come your way. So we have workshops coming up all over North America, New York, California, Toronto. And I also go across the pond once in a while, and I'm going to be in London, England in August and probably September too. So send me an email at craig@godfather.com. Let's grow your business together. And you can also visit perfectlifeworkshop.com to apply to work with me at my next coaching event near you.